Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. I think it's fair to say that director Sir Ridley Scott has one of the most diverse resumes of any filmmaker. He certainly doesn't stick to one genre. Ridley is the man behind the science fiction horror chestburster blockbuster Alien.
In space, no one can hear you scream.
Did you hear that? No, because we recorded that scream in space. Ridley also pretty much invented science fiction noir with Blade Runner. And let's not forget that he directed the landmark feminist film, Thelma and Louise. Ian Nathan is a film critic and the author of the book, Ridley Scott, A Retrospective. Ian has interviewed Ridley on several occasions, and we interviewed Ian on one occasion from his home in London via Zoom. Ian says that meeting with Scott over the years taught him that even though Ridley rarely smiles, his passion for film is always there.
He's very different, I think, from a lot of directors. He's not interested in, you know, his own mythology. He's not interested in revealing himself particularly. He loves to talk detail. He loves to talk, you know, how he puts films together, the practicalities of things. He doesn't suffer fools particularly. So you've got to be on your game. He has this lovely little trick that I've kind of managed to stand up to, where he sort of tests your knowledge of the history of film by idly throwing something in conversation, sort of pretending to forget something. Who directed The Third Man? And he'll sort of go, waiting for you to fill in the gap. And luckily, I was on my game, went, Carol Reed. And he's like, right, you know. So if you fail at that, he will despair of you. But I love it because there's a very dry sense of humor that sort of underpins his kind of view of the world.
Yeah. Ridley set up his own advertising company, Ridley Scott Associates, before he started making films. How has making commercials, including the iconic 1984 Macintosh spot, how has that work influenced the way he approaches making movies?
Incredibly. It's probably the most important part of his training. He called it his film school because he never went to film school. He went to art school. He trained a little bit at the BBC before he went to made his advertising company. But that idea of developing very small sort of narratives to sell something, to create the idea of desire and desirability, you know, around whatever product it is, from Apple Macintoshes to soap powder to clothing. You know, he's done over 2,000 adverts. I think he's absolutely, you know, was taken into his filmmaking.
We shall prevail.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
All his worlds, you know, in feature films, have a kind of desirability written into their DNA. Even something like Alien or Blade Runner, which is a dystopia, you kind of want to be there. You want to kind of, there's something romantic as well about it. Although it's a ruined future, there's something kind of rather lovely about it at the same time. That just comes with that kind of advertising look that he has. It's sort of an instinct for him.
Mm-hmm. I really like this Ridley Scott quote. It might be my favorite quote from him. Every film you see should at least bring you on a psychological journey. I'm curious, which Scott film has taken you on the most intense psychological journey?
I suppose I measure that, and that idea of what is your favorite and what kind of film do you love the most, really about how many times I return to it, how many times I kind of try and reinterpret it. And it is Blade Runner in that respect. I adore Alien, don't get me wrong. I adore many of his other films. But Blade Runner sort of haunted me since the first time I saw it. And to this day, there are elements of it that are still ambiguous in my head, and I don't understand about the nature of being a human being and about what it is to die and live. And so the idea of mortality and the idea of our future and the idea of filmmaking is wrapped into it. It's a film of many different genres at once. That's endlessly intrigued me. And as much as it's a film that plays on the senses, you know, how beautiful it is and how densely packed it is, it's also a film that sort of plays on your mind and your psyche and your imagination, because, you know, it's coming sort of around the edges of it. It's another world that sort of exists. You know, the great sort of valedictory speech that Roy Batty gives, you know, as he died.
All those moments will be lost in time. Like tears in rain. Time
your mind just goes off into these realms in which this film lives. And that's just stayed with me since I saw it. I must have been sort of 10 or 11 when I first saw it. And I've seen it, you know, it must be 20 or 30 times since, but every time it opens up again for me.
Mm-hmm. You say that Blade Runner is Ridley Scott's most personal film, his shape-shifting masterpiece. How so?
Well, I suppose I say personal because it was sort of born of a very strange time in his life. He sort of wanted to get out of science fiction. He'd done Alien, it'd been a very big success, and he tried to do Dune, and that hadn't come together. And I think he was looking to do other things. And what happened was his brother, his older brother, Frank, had died, a very young man, of cancer. And he'd been knocked back by this. And I think he made Blade Runner to try and escape the grief of losing his older brother. And it was a film and a script that talked about mortality and talked about death and then tried to interpret these things. And that is a theme that you can see again and again in his work, this idea of where do we come from? What are we here for? Very big sort of existential themes. In films like even like the Counselor, they kind of reoccur. But it's in Blade Runner, you find that the heart of him. And also, obviously, visually, I think Blade Runner is the most complete execution of the Ridley Scott vision.
Yeah, definitely. I think you're absolutely right about that. Let's talk about Ridley's breakthrough feature film, Alien. You describe Alien as a triumph of minimalism. How so?
Well, if you actually look at the film, and yeah, it's obviously become a classic of the genre, there's actually very little in terms of scale and scope to it. There's about, I think, three different places it exists. It exists on the Nostromo, their spaceship. It exists on the planet briefly, the actual LV-426, the kind of storm-racked planet. And it exists in the derelict, the alien spacecraft that we see John Hurt go into and find all the eggs. So there's only actually three locations. And in terms of actually what the plot is, it is simply pilots of a spacecraft follow a distress beacon, find this alien egg, it stows away within one of them, it breaks out on the spaceship. Will they survive? Yeah, it's a B-movie, and Scott said so. He said it's a B-movie with an A creature, and he said it had this lovely purring engine of a plot. There's no fuss to it. You know, there are kind of things around the edges I love about it that suggest a bigger world, you know, what the company were doing, the whole kind of look of it has a kind of gothic feel to it, you know, all that kind of a Giga kind of material. But at its heart, it's about these kind of crew getting taken out one by one to the point where there's one more left and it's will she survive? It's a very, very simple plot. It's a horror movie plot. You know, Ridley Scott said it's a haunted house movie, basically. But he just made something classic with it. You know, he injected it with all his look and his feel. So it became so much more.
Originally, the protagonist, Ripley, was going to be a man. How did making the leading man into a leading lady, played by Sigourney Weaver, how did that change the way we view Alien?
What I love about the fact that Ripley is a woman and so well played by Sigourney Weaver is that it is a feminist statement. It is radical for its time. It reinvented the idea of heroes in science fiction. But that's not the point, because the point is, it's just, will she survive? You know, it's a primal human storyline. And we forget. It's so well done that we don't sit there going, God, it's a woman, isn't that amazing? We just go, will she live? Will she live? Come on, you know, stay with her. But it had, you know, since, I think it had a huge effect on cinema and portrayal of women in cinema, certainly in terms of genre. And it's sort of gone on. It's the ripples outwards from Alien are massive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk about Thelma and Louise. It's a quieter and more grounded film than Alien and Blade Runner. I'd even forgotten that it was directed by Ridley Scott. What was it about the story of Thelma and Louise that intrigued him?
It's interesting. I think he began as a producer. The script had come to him through his company, through his second in command. He read it and brought it to him. Really, we should produce this. And he was very keen, very excited by the idea and the concept, but he didn't really want to do it himself. He didn't feel he was right for it. But in the long development process, as they tried to find the right Thelma and the right Louise, and they tried to find the right director, it was him, Scott, who was the sticking point. He kept going, no, this director's not right. This cast isn't right. And at one point, it was going to be Jodie Foster and Michelle Pfeiffer as Thelma and Louise. And Scott was still producing at that point. And it was Michelle Pfeiffer who said, Ridley, you've got to direct this. The way you talk about it, the way you feel about it, because Scott was talking about how he wanted, you know, the roads to look, how he wanted this kind of classical idea of America. when he was he just left art school, he'd gone over an apprenticeship to ad companies in Manhattan. And before he went back to London, he did a pilgrimage across America in Greyhound buses. There's long roads and there's sort of desert countries. And so that was all in his head. And of course, if you look at Thelma and Louise, it has that advertiser's glint to it, that kind of glamour, even though he's kind of showing ordinary places, all the dust in the air and the kind of style. Yeah. It becomes far more of a Western. We end up in Utah, in John Ford country. You know, the kind of world around them becomes more mythological as they become more outlaw, as they take on this kind of mantle of the kind of couple on the lam, almost, in the great movie tradition. So like, a bit like Blade Runner, it starts to draw on sort of classic movie tropes as it goes along. And this represents their awakening, you know, their sense of sort of coming together and who they are. And that sense that this is a trip of no return, that you know, once they've crossed that line, they've gone into this world, they're not coming back from it. And so I think as it goes on, of course, we get to the very famous finale. That's what Scott wanted. He wanted this kind of this art, this trajectory from a miserable life and a humble life to something glorious and movie-like.
Okay, then, listen. Let's not get caught. What are you talking about? Let's keep going. What do you mean? Go! You sure? Yeah.
Hey! I find that very powerful. And I love that there's a kind of euphoria as well as tragedy written into it. You know, you see the car go over the lip of the canyon, but it never quite descends. So they're sort of soaring still. You know? So we never see the crash or anything like that. And I think that's left audiences, you know, certainly they were perplexed by it, but perplexed in a good way. It leaves you questioning. And I think that's always a good quality to have in a movie.
Absolutely. Ridley's most successful film is Gladiator, which was released in 2000. You describe Gladiator as Scott's greatest hits album. What do you mean?
It carries a little bit of all the things he does well from all different films. So it has, as we were talking about, great music and great use of music. It's big. It has that great Hollywoodness he can do, that he makes big films, and big genre films. It has the visual aspect to it, that it's fabulous to look at times. And I think it has something of Ridley's kind of joy in that he's got this toy box to play with, CGI and creating the Colosseum. It has that kind of lovely sort of texture of physical things. You got to play with tigers on the set. You got chariots and horse riders, all the kind of the immensity of what he got to do. Yet intimacy as well, very personal things. He's good at character. He's not given enough credit for how good he is at character.
I knew a man who once said death smiles at us all. All a man can do is smile back.
I wonder, did your friend smile at his own death?
You must know. He was your father.
That Maximus comes alive as a sort of tragic character. Joaquin Phoenix, as the emperor, he's not a full villain. He is a tragic character. He's out of his depth. He's gone slightly mad, but he's a lonely child. He's a boy. And I think that comes across in the film as well.
Mm-hmm. Ian, before we let you go, one of Beta's fans, who we call Alphas, is a big Ridley Scott fan. Alpha James from Stoughton, Wisconsin, sent in this question for you. Take it away, James.
Hi, Ian. It's a great book and one that makes me actually lament not having a coffee table to put it on. But that aside, which Ridley Scott project do you feel he regrets not being able to make so far? There's still time, but which one do you feel is the most personal to him and that he really should make? Thanks for the question. I'll take my answer off air.
That sounded very much like a British voice. That's nice to hear.
Yeah.
It's an interesting question. I think Ridley Scott, he's not a man of great regrets. I don't think he looks back particularly. You know, a flop or hit, he moves on and he's already making the next film. So he's not particularly a man to sort of return to films that haven't come to pass. He was going to do a film called I Am Legend that was later made with Will Smith. and he had Arnold Schwarzenegger in the lead role, and they were planning this big $100 million production. They were going to shoot in San Francisco, and he had had all these kind of zombies and creatures designed, and he was very upset when that fell apart. And, you know, I think in a certain way, and I think he appreciates what they did with Blade Runner 2049, but I listened to kind of him talk about the film, and maybe just get a hint to the fact that maybe he slightly regrets that, you know, he didn't make, you know, the sequel to his own great masterpiece, that he wasn't the man in charge, that he might have gone about it in a slightly different way. You don't get a lot of, you know, Ridley confessing things like that, but you can pick up on the slight disappointment there. These have turned out as a film he wouldn't have made. I do quite like it, but from Ridley's perspective.
Ian Nathan, thank you very much.
Thank you. Been a pleasure.
Ian Nathan is a film critic and the author of Ridley Scott, A Retrospective. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Gabriel Byrne, Sasha Geffen, and Ian Nathan. And a special thanks to Alpha James.
I will win the crowd. I will give them something they've never seen before.
If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast. It's available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Maybe I've jeopardized the rest of us, but it was a risk I was willing to take.
Our executive producer, nay showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
Combat model, optimum self-sufficiency. Probably the leader.
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
Are you not entertained? Is this not why you are here?